Welcome to A World of Fragile Truths, a podcast by the knowledge platform Security and Rule of Law, where we unpack the latest evidence for our field, which show the assumptions under the sector's work are often fragile. My name is Christian Kuitert, and today we dive into the world of uncomfortable partnerships. A string of coups and regime changes in 2021 and 2022 triggered again this question, how the international community should respond to such situations. Our guest, Betty Wainaina from the New York University Center on International Cooperation, worked on a report that highlights responsible options for continued engagement. And we unpack this with the help of Dr. Idris Nasri, who researches Islamic law at the Universiteit Paderborn, but also implemented development work in Afghanistan himself, where he was also born and raised. Welcome, Betty and Idris.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we'll talk about uncomfortable partnerships today. Hopefully this podcast will not be an example of an uncomfortable partnership. How are you feeling?
All good, Christian.
With uncomfortable partnerships, I of course refer to those between donor countries and what you, Betty, call politically estranged settings. What are these settings?
So the settings we look at in this report are in four categories. So first is situations where national authorities have gained rulership through unconstitutional means, such as coups, examples like Afghanistan that we'll be talking about. We have situations where the elections have taken place, but they are considered widely contested. Examples such as Venezuela. Then we have situations where there's been an unconstitutional regime, but it's considered in transition towards a constitutional movement. And this is the case of what Sudan was before April. And the last category we look at is where we have comprehensive sanctions.
So four quite different situations then. And why would a country like, let's say Germany then, where you live, Idris, why would you still engage in such situations? I can already hear a German parliamentarian saying, like, you know, why are we still giving money to country X or still doing this and that? You know, they violate human rights or don't share our values. So why is that still important?
I mean, you have to be realistic in regard specifically to Afghanistan. You need to be that honest to see you engaged in a country 20 years. You had, by your engagement, a responsibility to millions of Afghans. Okay, if we say it was just because of own interests in this country, then we need to be dead honest at the end to say this did not work in Afghanistan, in Iraq, or somewhere else. But we have a responsibility to the Afghans, regardless of the regime. And then the next question would be, what's the alternative? So there must be a smart alternative to it. And if this politician would ask me that, I would just ask him that, just give me a smart alternative to it.
Can I add something to that?
Yeah.
I think, as Idris says, we do need to separate the regime from the people. We still have an international obligation to protect and preserve people's lives. And that is not contested. It doesn't matter what the relationship with the authorities is. But secondly, is that the reality is that a lot of this context are the arena of geopolitical contestation. There's been a sort of disconnect and double standards with the way the international community has responded to the different crises. The other thing is that the humanitarian only approaches, because they have not succeeded in being localized as much as possible, is that they've tended to be very expensive. And the value for money is actually a very compelling argument for any taxpayer or any constituency within donor countries. And so when we sort of put this argument forward to donor constituencies, I think one of the things that they fear is that we'd be legitimizing an unlawful regime, or we'd be putting our money at risk to fiduciary risks. And the thing that I feel or we recommend within the report is that curating of that messaging and convincing domestic constituencies that indeed it is possible to deliver aid within modalities that are sensible and can avoid some of these risks, and that Zero tolerance to corruption or zero tolerance to abuse does not mean that there will not be corruption or that there will not be abuse, but we have the modalities in place to detect when this happens and to take action to redress these situations when they occur.
So what would then be examples of smart ways to still stay engaged without legitimizing or gains that are made by support are then claimed by leaders who actually, you know, didn't take responsibility?
So we sort of did a scan of literature to see the extent to which aid does legitimize regimes. We find in contexts where there is some level of estrangement or other fragile states context, that indeed the relationship was quite weak between aid and the legitimization of regimes, that communities and populations are able to distinguish between aid that is being brought in by external parties and what is delivered as part of the social contract by their own governments. And so when we look at modalities that have been applied, as much as possible, we look at opportunities or examples of modalities that have been as localized as possible, because that then ensures that the engagement of local communities and local institutional frameworks is actually also supporting with regards to the delivery of the benefits. And the ones that then we explore, for example, are use of ring fencing mechanisms where you ring fence payments within sectors. We look at NGO contracting, especially through coordinated service agreements. We also look at community-driven approaches where you transfer resources directly to communities and you give them the power to manage the resources and also the decision-making. Regional approaches, which are actually quite useful, especially where you have regional programs, so you can then pool and distribute the risk so that then it's not only the respective country that you're dealing with. And then the other one we look at is working with semi-autonomous agencies where this have been in existence before.
Semi-autonomous from the government.
Yes, semi-autonomous from the government.
Mm-hmm. So if you hear this list, either is, you know, work you can work in maybe a more localized way or community-driven way, or have with specific limitations to ring fence funding, work with semi-autonomous, the whole list. And then look at what the response was in Afghanistan. Do you feel like this range of options has been used at all?
I mean, in Afghanistan, we need to admit that from the beginning till today, there's no plan. There's no clear plan what to do with the country. So just give you an example. We had this idea that this frozen funds, the 7 billions, that were frozen by the American Biden administration, would in any way hurt the Taliban. So then the half of it, they just give to the victims of the 9/11 without any law and without any profound reason. And then the rest, the 3.5 billion, they just transfer to Swiss, where they still don't have an idea what to do with it. So what I want to say is, of all that, what Betty mentioned, we could use each of them because they are just parts of one bigger plan. Mm-hmm. We could use them in a different ways because they are just tools of one and the same goal that we have. But the reason would, the necessity would be that we would have a plan and a clear goal how to deal with it. And I don't see that in Afghanistan.
Are there parts of the international community beyond maybe the humanitarian aid sector that are more willing to engage and to keep lines of communication and support open?
I'm definitely sure of that. But just give you a small example, if you start to get engaged in countries like Afghanistan, and I'm sure we will get that same issue in Sudan, because then we start with the same thing to ask ourselves, okay, who's the party that would be more in a way interesting for our own main goals? And if we really want to support that, there is no way around then to get engaged with the government that we have right now in Afghanistan. If it's de facto, if it's a regime, if it's a terror group, whatever it is.
Hmm.
I think what Idris is actually saying is very relevant and It's the reality of this context. Because when estrangement does take place, one of the things we see is that sort of donors go into this long churning process and a sense of inertia without quite doing anything. Within that time, we had a buildup of close to 20 million people at the risk of facing starvation. And human suffering does not wait. It continues to become worse as time progresses. So when we come into these situations, I think the categorization of what the objectives are for engagement needs to be very clear from donors. The first is that we have an obligation to protect and to preserve the lives of the people in these countries. The next thing is that we want to ensure that the country does not completely collapse. Yeah, because when the country completely collapses, then we cannot be able to help people, for example, or we cannot be able even to address some of the big concerns that donors have around mass displacement of populations and the whole refugee crisis, for example. And building on that, I think there's something I'd want to also speak to, because the sort of default towards humanitarian only approaches in this context, we find is not sufficient. Yeah. Humanitarian was never designed to be a long-term approach. It's actually for emergency and a stopgap measure, and then development would check in. So we recommend, because a lot of these situations as they're happening, some of them are ending up in very protracted timeframes. And you need to then look at some functions that would actually help with delivery of aid, for example, providing utilities that help delivery of aid, such as in the health sector, macroeconomic functions such as payment systems and currency exchange systems, because without this, then we cannot even deliver aid. We need to think about sustaining some level of community dispute resolution mechanisms and some level of community organizing. And also
that's a dispute resolution and accountability is, I think, something that I want to come back on, because as a knowledge platform, security and rule of law, of course, justice and security themes are very close to what our listeners are working with. And these are very also politically sensitive topics, maybe a bit more so than humanitarian aid or healthcare. So, well, first, this is a teaser. First, we listen to another colleague's thoughts on engagement with politically estranged settings. But after that, I'd like to hear a bit more about those specific themes.
When I think about remaining engaged with politically estranged settings such as Afghanistan, think about how donors' disengagement can affect a country's social fabric, including local and national NGOs' ability to respond to needs in a principled way. My name is Alexandra Singpil, and I'm the localization advisor with DRC in Afghanistan. Local and national organizations are the ones deeply rooted in affected communities, with close links, thus also high expectations from them. And at the same time, they are very often confronted with more interference attempts from the de facto authorities. And yet, they have little to no backup and support from the international community, including on the funding side. The current restrictions are disproportionately affecting national actors, and today they are struggling to keep operating and are at risk of falling apart, which will ultimately limit our collective ability to deliver to the most in need. So we have a joint responsibility to support them, and donors have a vital role to play there. They can create platforms for direct engagement, they can carve space for dialogue and support, and they can also support exploring acceptable ways of in-country engagement to ease the pressure humanitarian actors face and to ensure that local and national actors can continue their vital work.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts. Idris, as I said before the break, yeah, justice and security themes are quite political and, yeah, sensitive in many ways, maybe a bit more even so. I mean, everything is political, of course, but than some of the other themes that we touched upon. So do you indeed also see less room for collaboration on such topics, or is that actually very possible in the context of Afghanistan right now?
For example, what do you mean? What?
Well, I think supporting access to justice, security of people, reforming security sector, these kind of topics, right?
Definitely. It is hard to work, but it doesn't mean that there is not a frame for it. Afghanistan is not a black hole that we don't know what to do. I think we were that much engaged like nowhere else. And so It's not a black box that we don't know how to deal with the security and circumstances, and we don't know who would be a partner to talk to. But the thing is, the question would be where to start. And I think there are different ways who we could get engaged with. We have a community based. Afghanistan is still a very has a very huge rural area where you can get engaged with community actors, where you can engage with different parts of Afghanistan. That means which province are you talking to, who's the person who wants to be get engaged with you. And you can get different supporters for your own main goal. That doesn't mean that the one is not accepting your concept, that the entire Afghan context would not accepting it. So you can find partners in different parts of Afghanistan if you look for them. So there would be parts, if it's empowering women, if it's empowering marginalized groups, so there would be groups that would support that. But this needs, of course, the support also from the donors, and especially the Western countries, who would say, yes, we support ways around the regime. We support even ways which maybe support the wings which are more inclusive, more for the country in a way than these wings which are maybe not maybe compatible with the international human rights, for example.
I think one of the things that tends to really be a problem for actors in this context is that when the situation goes bust, we all assume we have nothing to work with.
Yeah.
And we think that everything has collapsed and everything has, you know, has sort of died out. And I think that's a problem we have in this context. Afghanistan, for example, and as Idris had said, we've been here for 20 years. We understand this context so much because the level of engagement has been very intense. But if you look, for example, at what the Afghanistan Reconstruction Trust Fund was funding over the past years before the takeover by Taliban, one of the programs was the Afghanistan Solidarity Program, which is a community-driven approach, in a sense, working through the community councils. Now, those councils exist. Those networks already exist. Of course, with some level of political economy, you can reevaluate them and see which ones is possible to work with. Can we also then support these communities in addition to what it is that they were doing that can then begin to also build the building block for peace building at the community level? Yeah, because strengthening the peace building architecture within the community is as important as strengthening that architecture away from the federal system, the national level.
So I suppose a few fragile truths, if we would look at the theme of our podcast in this episode, I hear already are, you know, separating definitely government and people, but also then looking at the nuances within, well, organizations like the Taliban and knowing that, you know, there are many different wings and forms, and that, yeah, it is you're building. It, not everything has sort of broken down all of a sudden, but there are as many structures that you can build on.
Exactly, Christian.
Well, Betty, I know that you wanted to also dive into the role of the diaspora. What can be their role?
I think what we find is that it's impossible to completely disengage and not have a dialogue. So some level of engagement is necessary, some level of dialogue is necessary, irrespective of the degree of estrangement. And why is this important? One is because it provides us the mechanism to continually sort of monitor the progress and looking forward to where there are opportunities for more meaningful engagement. The diaspora in donor countries actually play a very important role in terms of helping domestic donor constituencies understand the context of these countries. But even more so, I see that there's an opportunity for them actually to play a role with regards to informing not only the engagement, but also playing a role as part of the dialogue. And I think this is an area that we've not quite well advanced. I know setups such as the EU, for example, have thought through how to engage diaspora more in more structured ways. And we see the influence of, for example, diaspora groups, even in the US. The Venezuela diaspora group is very influential, actually, in driving the US's engagement and the US's decisions around Venezuela, for example.
Yeah, and I think especially in the case of Afghanistan, you have millions of Afghans since the first war during the Russian invasion in Afghanistan till today. We have a huge brain drain that leaves Afghanistan, who were very well educated women and men, and who were very much engaged in the context. So they can play a crucial role, as Betty, as you said. And especially, I think that the role can be also to challenge the regime, for example, in Afghanistan. I mean, they say we are the true Afghans. So we are the only Afghans, mm-hmm. to even maybe show them in the mirror how they are. So their ideology is the same like in the past, other regimes who excluded the rest of Afghanistan, who excluded the marginalized groups from the powerful one. So they're doing the same thing, living now in the same palaces like the past elite that they were criticizing.
You know, even just building on that, the other constituency that I feel is not only the regional networks, but neighbors. And for example, especially with respect to Afghanistan and the whole question around the interpretation of the role and place of women and women's access to education and how this is being framed as an ideological requirement has been challenged by the Organization of Islamic Countries. I feel that them playing that role is actually more strategic than non-Islamic donors coming in and trying to convince the Taliban that this is the way to do it. And I think just having them being as the front that leads that dialogue would actually be a much more strategic
Absolutely.
Way of engaging the Taliban.
Absolutely better.
They often also play a role in the conflict itself. In most of the conflicts, neighboring countries also have a role to play. So ignoring them would also actually be ignoring part of the problem and the solution, I suppose.
Absolutely.
We're getting already close to the end. So maybe drawing, some, let's say, key next steps or key points of improvement. Maybe Idris, what do, and now we're talking, our listeners are mostly, let's say, either working with or working at more Western donors. What are the really key next step to improve current engagement with Afghanistan?
I think the main and most important thing is to establish infrastructure and dialogue platforms. And I think the dialogue platform can be in different ways. We can do it on a justice level. We can do it on a reconciliation level.
What would that look like?
I mean, just imagine the EU would decide on that aspect. So we would like to invite all the important wings from the Taliban to Bonn and let's discuss with all the Afghans we have in Europe and the Western world and find ways for Afghanistan. We just give you the frame. It's not that we tell you what to do.
So you're saying get over that fear of giving a government legitimacy, because I think that is a big argument of why it's not happening, right? And actually,
I agree.
Make those platforms possible.
So for legitimization, there are different levels by the international law who will be legitimized and how. But the first thing we need is a platform to discuss. This doesn't mean we legitimize any terror regime, but we give them the chance to be challenged and to challenge. And by the next step, we can find solution to maybe the Afghan way, how they would solve their issues. And this can be a way how we can get engaged with them. It's not that we just would say, see, these guys are discriminating women, not just by international law, but also by classical Islamic law. But for that, we need a platform and we need to discuss with them and invite them.
Yeah, thanks. And Betty, if you would look at, let's say, more broader, the donors' knee-jerk responses in situations, those four, let's say, situations of change or estrangement, what would be the key factor, you say, to improve responses?
I think all that we've put forward within, you know, the menu of options for modalities for delivery and oversight, this provides a guide on what is possible to do. And a lot of people in the field actually did sort of say to us, it would really be helpful if we had a guide from headquarters that told us, these are the range of options that you have, and it would speed up a lot of the delay that happens with regards to action. But even speaking more generally about, even sort of drilling down back to Afghanistan and sort of zooming back in, we have to understand that one is, with regards to its geopolitical strategic location, that Afghanistan is quite key, but also that it's one of the biggest producers of poppies. Mm-hmm. And that poses a big problem for the globe more generally. So I think just a resolution needs to be found with regards to how to engage. I was listening to the interview by the Deputy Special Representative for UNAMA.
Very briefly.
Just the Taliban is what we have for now. So thinking through how to work with what we have for now is actually a pragmatic approach. So burying our heads and deciding not to do anything or waiting until things change to fit us completely may not take place. But in the meantime, can we work with what we have? And what ways can we work with what we have? What ways in which we can bypass what we would not like to work with and still ensure that we are building bridges to ensure that we have a system that can deliver for the people eventually.
Yeah, I think those comments on the drug trade actually link also to the past two episodes' comments on the Colombian case. And I think an important point you mentioned is to just read the report. It's called The Aid Strategies in Politically Estranged Settings, How Donors Can Stay and Deliver in Fragile and Conflict-Affected States. And then, translate that into good guidance, good guidelines. So I hope that policymakers and parliamentarians alike have been taking notes this episode. And thank you so much for coming both. We could have gone on for quite a long time, I feel, because it was super interesting. And also a big thanks to you, dear listener, for joining us again. Stay alert for those fragile truths out there. And we'll hear from each other next month.